Today is Thursday, October 4th, 2007. My name is Alicia Sell, and I am interviewing today Mr. Ray Garland, and we are interviewing in the Parrot Room at Main Library on Jefferson Street. Thank you for being with us today, Mr. Garland. We're going to start with some background questions about you. Can you tell us where and when were you born?
I was born, the old address was 519 Belleville Road in Raleigh Court on the 20th of May of 1934, at home.
Okay. And how long did you live in that particular house?
21 years.
Okay. Did you have any siblings?
Yes, I had two older brothers. Walter B. Garland, Jr. was 15 years older than myself, and he is deceased. And Robert A. Garland was 11 years older, and he's still living here in Roanoke.
Can you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names, and where did they come from?
My father was Walter Berman Garland. He was born in or near the town of Buchanan in Botetourt County in March of 1893. And my mother was born in Goochland County, which is just near Richmond, in October of 1893. And her grandfather, Everett Ranson, lived in Buchanan and was a storekeeper there. And in Goochland County, they did not have a school past the seventh grade. But in the town of Buchanan, they did. In fact, they had a high school. And he wanted his granddaughter to come up to Buchanan to finish school, which she did. And that's where she met my father. And she graduated from high school there in Buchanan, which was a fairly unusual thing in Virginia in 1910, 1911. And she taught briefly in the Botetourt County schools. She did go up to Farmville and took a little summer course, because in those days very few teachers in Virginia had a college degree, but she did take a little bit of college. And they married in October of 1915, when they were approximately 22 years of age, and settled in Roanoke. My father's older sister, Ira Mundy, had come to Roanoke and was running a boarding house on the site of the present Patrick Henry Hotel. And my father came to Roanoke on the train, the old N&W line that went up to Hagerstown, Maryland, went through Buchanan, through several little stops, Lithia, Nance, Cloverdale, Hollins, and on into Roanoke. And he came into Roanoke on the train, and he took up residence in his sister's boarding house, and he got a job working at Clore's Drugstore, which is a building that still very much stands today on the corner of East Campbell and Williamson Road. And now that space is occupied by Twists and Turns. And Mr. Clore had a drugstore there, and he hired my father for what he said was a dollar a day to work in the store. And in those days, they didn't have refrigeration for the ice cream and so forth. So the blocks of ice were delivered early in the morning, and it was his job to go in there and chip the ice, which is about as hard a job as you can have, and pack it around the ice cream. And he was very popular with Mr. Clore, but the Norfolk and Western offices were nearby, and a number of the people that worked for the Norfolk and Western were customers in the store. And they told my father that he should come over and get a job at the Norfolk and Western, which he did for $65 a month. This would have been in 1913 or 1914. But he was very unhappy doing office work, and Mr. Clore wanted him back, and so he came back to Mr. Clore, and Mr. Clore made him a partner in the store. I have never known exactly how that arrangement, whether Mr. Clore took a note or my father had saved up enough money to make a down payment. Then Mr. Clore decided that he wanted to go back to Culpeper, which is where he was from, and he sold my father the other half of the store. And it wasn't long before he decided he wanted to come back to Roanoke, and my father sold him his half of the store back. And then Mr. Clore decided that they should open a store on Grandin Road, which would have been, I believe I'm correct in saying it was in the old building as at the corner of Maiden Lane and Grandin. It has two apartments upstairs and two storerooms downstairs. And they bought a failing drugstore there, a Schaefer Pharmacy. And then Mr. Clore decided that he wanted to move his store down on Grandin Road, further down on Grandin Road. And so he bought my father's half of that store out and located it right near the corner of Westover and Grandin Road in a fairly small space. And he was the branch post office, which was very common in those days, that the post office did not establish branches everywhere but would contract with a store. In the country, it was more often a general store. On Grandin Road, Mr. Clore had the post office contract. And then when he died in 1942 or 43, then my father bought that store back. And so we owe really everything to Mr. Clore because he got my father in the drug business. My father went on to have a number of small drug stores in Roanoke, all in the city of Roanoke, one on Main Street, Wasina, one on Jamison Avenue Southeast, one on Dale Avenue, corner of Dale and 9th Street, one on the corner of Walnut and Jefferson, and there were 8 or 9 of them. They didn't amount to much. They were all small stores. But when my brother Bob came out of pharmacy school in 1949, he went to the store that Mr. Clore had on Grandin Road. And Bob was just a tremendous merchant. He had the great power of attracting customers. He really wanted to please the customer in every way. And the store was just phenomenally successful very quickly. That area was growing. That was the post-World War II. The people had come back from the service. They were setting up their families. They were having babies. Housing was relatively scarce, and of course there was very limited development out in the county, so people that came here had to live in the city. So I have often said that Bob Garland was probably the greatest merchant, homegrown merchant, that Roanoke ever produced. And it wasn't long before we went across the street and built what was then one of the largest drugstores in the whole country. And it later became, as it developed, probably the number one drugstore in the whole nation. And that's, of course, is not what I say, but it's what people who were in that business and were dealing with drugstores, companies like Procter & Gamble and so forth, that they would come there and they would say, well, there's nothing like this in the whole country. It certainly was a phenomenal success. So that is pretty much our history.
When you were growing up here in Roanoke, you said that your father lived in his sister's boarding house. Is that correct?
That's when he first came to Roanoke, before he got married. He did, yeah.
Other than his sister, were there other family members living close by?
Well, as a matter of fact, all of his brothers and sisters, except one, and there was a very large family. I think there were 8 children altogether, and 7 of the 8 children ended up coming to Roanoke. Because Roanoke was, in the period of the early part of this century and for many years thereafter, Roanoke was a tremendously progressive city and a very prosperous city. That prosperity was in large measure due to the railroad, because even during the Depression, the trains continued to run and the Norfolk and Western didn't. Unlike a number of railroads in the country, never went bankrupt. It continued to pay a dividend all through the Depression. because we were people still had to have electric power, and the Norfolk & Western was of course mainly a coal hauling railway, and it remained prosperous. And Roanoke of course developed public water, public sewage, and a very good system of public schools. And those things, if we go back 100 years or even 50 or 60 years, those things were relatively rare. And so the city was a tremendous beacon for people that came out of places like my father, who had grown up on a farm. And he could see very clearly, as his brothers saw, that there was not going to be any great future on the farm, because, of course, American agriculture was moving toward the Middle West, where you had the broad acres and where you could use technology. They could afford the technology, and that the small farms in Virginia were not going to be very prosperous. Now, my grandfather, who died long before I was born, was a very successful farmer, but he had four or five sons, and they obviously were not all going to prosper on the farm. So all but one ended up coming to Roanoke, and most of them ended up working for my father.
A quick question about your father. Did he have training in pharmacy before he worked for it?
No, he did not. And that was always a little bit of a sad thing, because in those days, up until the middle of the 1930s, you could get a pharmacy license by simply taking an examination. You didn't have to go to college. And he could probably have gotten that, but he never did. The only thing I think that remains of that today, I believe it is still possible for a lawyer to, as they say, read the law under a senior lawyer and to take the bar exam. The legal profession, like the pharmacy profession, has tried to get rid of that because, of course, they want to restrict and control the people coming into the profession. And my father was never a pharmacist, and that was a great drawback, really, because in the drugstore business, in order to operate a drugstore, a prescription department, you must have a license. So he always had to depend upon someone who was a licensed pharmacist in his stores, and not all were pharmacies. All of them originally were pharmacies, but a few of them he never operated as a pharmacy. He just operated them as a soda fountain, a place that sold bread and milk and patent medicines, toothpaste, because, of course, in those days, we didn't have 7-Elevens. The grocery stores were very small. They didn't stock toothpaste and all of that, and you didn't have Walmart and Kmart and those places. So the drugstore is where people went to get almost all of their health and beauty aids. And food, of course. We always felt that the food was very crucial because people have to eat so many times a day, and they don't require an aspirin or a tube of toothpaste that many times a day. But on Grandin Road, when we developed the large store, we actually had three restaurant areas in the store that seated approximately 200 people. So it was an incredible restaurant operation as well as a drugstore.
Was that the Lamplight?
The Gaslight.
The Gaslight.
The Gaslight was one of the three. We had the Grill and Soda Room, which was the traditional soda fountain and booths and stools. And then we had another large dining room behind that. And then upstairs above, we had the Gaslight, which was the last of the Gaslight and the kitchen. The drugstore was truly a phenomenal operation. We often talk about it because it's like a deceased member of the family. We employed two full-time bakers upstairs to bake pies and bread. We had six or seven full-time delivery men. My brother Bob was a person that wanted to stock everything that anybody could possibly call for within reason, that would be within a drugstore. And I often tell the story about how extreme he was in that respect. When people used fountain pens and they bought ink, he stocked three different brands of ink in six or seven different colors each. He had Carter's ink, which in the 1950s sold for 10 cents a bottle. He had Schaefer's ink, which sold for 15 cents a bottle. And he had Parker's ink, which sold for 25 cents a bottle. He had it in lavender. He had it in green. He had it in red. He had it in blue. He had it in blue-black. He had it in black. Crepe paper. He had probably, in fact, we had so many different shades of crepe paper that I designed a special cabinet to keep the crepe paper straight, because otherwise it would get all mixed up. Poster board, we had the same thing. We had poster board in 8 or 10 different colors, and I designed a special cabinet and had a cabinet maker make it to hold the poster board so that the colors wouldn't get mixed up. That was the kind of operation he had. It was truly phenomenal. It'll never be seen, never was seen before, and it'll never be seen again.
You were much younger than your brothers. Did you look up to them?
Well, because of the great gulf in age, I did not have a tremendous amount of association with them, because they were, of course, by the time I got up to be 4 or 5 years old, they were in college or about to go to college. Now, when Bob came back from and started the drugstore on Grandin Road in 1949, I went in with him as a partner, even though I was only 15 years of age. But and I did my part, but I give him the credit.
Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about the house that you grew up in. What was it like, and what was the street like that you grew up on? Did you have a lot of interaction with your neighbors?
It was a very typical early suburban street. This was happening all over the country. It was happening in Richmond. It was happening in Norfolk. It was happening in larger cities like Louisville and Cincinnati, that you had the streetcar suburbs. We had wonderful public transportation in Roanoke, both streetcars and buses. And this was a conventional square brick house. Had one bathroom in it. My father later finished the basement and the attic, so it was actually, and still today, is 4 stories of living space, but still only with one bathroom. But there were a great many children on the street, and it was a wonderful place to grow up. The schools were close. I walked every day down to Virginia Heights School and walked back home for lunch. We had an hour for lunch, and it was about a 10 or 12 minute walk, and I would walk it both ways. And then when I went on to Woodrow Wilson, of course, that was only a couple of blocks away too. They did not have a cafeteria at Woodrow Wilson, so again, I walked home for lunch. In fact, when I entered the first grade at Virginia Heights, which was in the old, what we call the little building, the original building was probably built about 1907 or 1908, we did not have electricity in the little building. That came, the Virginia Heights PTA got involved in raising the funds to install, helping to raise the funds. I'm not sure they paid for all of it, but I know they were involved in it, because we had a kind of a festival after we got the electricity in the little building. That would have been probably about 1941. I think I was in the second grade, possibly the third grade, so it would have been right at the beginning of the 1940s.
What kind of activities did you participate in? Did you play sports, or did you sing in the choir or anything?
Very little, actually, because from a very early age, I was working in the drugstores. So I started working in the drugstores when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And from then on, until we sold the drugstore, I was pretty much occupied with that.
Did you like working in the drugstore?
Well, it was tremendously exciting, because it's such a variety of things that happened in the drugstore. You had, happy days like Christmas Eve, where everybody was in a good mood, the store was tremendously busy, and then you would have crisis days, for example, when there was a heavy snow on the ground, and we were having great difficulty getting the deliveries out to the customers. And in fact, I remember one of the heaviest snows we ever had here, which I think was two consecutive snows, which would have been sometime in the mid-60s. We had about 24 inches of snow on the ground in Roanoke. And that day, we delivered over 600 packages, and some were going out as late as 1 o'clock in the morning. And, if you have can imagine taking 600 orders over the telephone and filling them and getting them out to the delivery people, making the corrections, because inevitably people would remember things that they wanted, that they'd call and say, could you add this to my order? Then they would call and ask where their order was. And that sometimes could be embarrassing because we would get behind.
Let's talk a little bit about a little bit more about your education. So you went to Virginia Heights Elementary, Woodrow Wilson,
and Jefferson High School. And I would say that I got a very superior grounding in all the basic skills that I needed to go on. I, for 12 years, I wrote a weekly newspaper column, and I made it my business to come down here to the Virginia Room, as a matter of fact, and look up the budget for the Roanoke City Public Schools in the year that I graduated from Jefferson, which was 1952. And I found that in that year, the Roanoke Public Schools spent $324 per student for that year, average. The cost today is over $9,000 per student per year. That this is a staggering change. As a historian, I have thought a great deal about the value of money relative to the 18th century, the 19th century, and the early part of the 20th century. And from 1952 to the present, you can multiply by approximately 10. So something that cost a dollar in 1952 will cost approximately $10 today. So the value of money has depreciated about 90% in that 50-year period. So if you said that $324, if you multiply by 10, we should only be spending something over $3,000 a year. But in fact, we're spending $9,000. So it's a completely different world. But I went on. I was going to go to pharmacy school, but I really had no talent for physics and biology, and so I was always very interested in history, and I decided that I wanted to teach and write history, so I became a history major, and I did some teaching both in the public schools and at the college level. I went on and got a graduate degree in history, and then I went into politics. So I never really taught history, though when I came back and wrote my weekly column for 12 years for the Roanoke Times and about 25 other Virginia newspapers, I certainly, my study of history and the methodology of history, the way you research things and the way you separate the wheat from the chaff, this came in very handy.
What college did you attend? Did you attend college?
I graduated from Roanoke College with a bachelor's degree in history, and I graduated from the University of Virginia with a master's degree in history, and I also did postgraduate study at the University of London in England. Very valuable course that they offered in the summer there that I was able to partake of on four different occasions. Very valuable.
These questions have a little bit to do with home life. Did your family gather around the radio in the evening? Did you have a telephone or a refrigerator?
Well, we certainly had a telephone and a refrigerator and a radio. My father was a person who didn't like to get out of the house early, but once he was out, he would stay out very late, and this. The main store that he worked at, he closed at 10 o'clock, and he would usually find a reason to hang around for another hour or two. So very often he wouldn't get home until midnight. And so in that sense, we didn't have a tremendous amount. I mean, it was not like somebody that worked at the North and Western and the husband came home at 5 o'clock and they sat down to dinner at 6 o'clock. It wasn't like that at all. But the radio was tremendously important to me, and I have often said that I was truly a child of the radio era, and I have always believed that in terms of being an influence, that radio possibly was greater than television, simply because you had to pay more attention to the radio. You had to follow what was being said. And those were very exciting times when I came of age, because I remember the day that Hitler invaded Poland in September of 1939. I was a little over 5 years old, and we were getting ready to go somewhere. And the afternoon paper came, and they had the big headline that the war had begun in Europe. The United States, of course, didn't get into the war until a little over 2 years later. But we were very much involved in the emotions of those days. And, of course, you had great radio voices. Today, to be successful on television, you require a somewhat innocuous voice, a conversational style voice. And people do not want any kind of oratorical style on television. It doesn't work. If you notice the successful preachers that are on television are people that have a very conversational style of speech. But growing up in the early 40s and listening to the radio, you had people like Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill that had this a great oratorical style of speaking, although Roosevelt mastered the conversational style with his fireside chats. But on his formal speeches, of course, they were more oratorical. Then we had these great newscasters of that period that had very distinctive voices, like William L. Shira and Edward R. Murrah. And the greatest that in my recollection was Gabriel Heater. He came on at, I believe, 9 o'clock for a 15-minute radio news. And he had a wonderful, soothing voice, but a very powerful voice. And he would begin his programs by saying, "Ah, there's good news tonight." Or there's bad news.
Locally, do you remember Hayden Huddleston?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Did you listen to any of his programs?
I certainly remember listening to him on radio. He had a quiz program on radio. And we thought it was pretty special. I forget what the prize was, but the question, as I recall, was who was regarded as the financier of the American Revolution? And I believe the answer was Gouverneur Morris, but I could be wrong about that. I know that was the question. And it stumped a great many people, but finally somebody got it. Then, of course, he was on television. And he, you know, had a very comfortable local manner, and you couldn't help but like his shows. And there were other personalities like him that were around. There's the legendary Herndon Slicer was on WDBJ radio. He played the organ or the piano or whatever, and then there were several other people like that were local persons, just strictly local personalities, and were very, very highly celebrated. As I mean, if they would go down the street, somebody would see him, it would be like a celebrity. Because after all, we only had three channels in those days. And I just got satellite back this year. I'd been without it for the whole 15 years that I had lived in the country. And I had fought getting it because I knew what would happen. And I think I've got over 100 channels. So it's an incredible change from where you only had three channels to choose from.
Did you have any chores around your house that you were responsible for?
Well, my main chores were working in the stores, because there was always plenty to do in the stores. And as soon as I could get out and catch the bus or catch the streetcar and go downtown. I would be working in the stores.
Did your family have a car?
Yes, we always had a car. Mm-hmm.
What businesses and shops did your family shop at?
Well, a great variety, because being local merchants themselves, they had customers who were merchants, and they wanted to shop with those people. There were several small grocery stores down on the market, and of course my father's main drugstore, where he started, was down on East Campbell Avenue, what was then East Campbell and Randolph, today East Campbell and Williamson Road. And he, of course, wanted to shop with the people that were around there that came in the store. And there were a great many clothing stores downtown as well. And at least one of them, Mr. Morgan, I believe his name was, it owned Brotherhood Mercantile. He was a customer, and so when we bought clothes, we would go to Brotherhood, or we would go to Glenn Minnick. One of my parents' great friends was a clerk there, and we wanted to go and shop with her. So that really was the way it was in that time. It was more personal, and who you knew and where you were accustomed to going.
Did you ever go to, like, the movies or concerts or football games?
Well, the movies, certainly, because we had the Grandin Theater down on Grandin Road, and that was quite convenient to me. My favorite, and I went to all of them. We had downtown, we had the Jefferson, we had the American, we had the Park, and we had the Rialto. And my favorite was the Rialto, because that specialized in Western films. And in the 1940s, somebody under the age of 12 could go to the Rialto for 10 cents, which would be roughly the equivalent of a dollar today. And you could get a bag of popcorn for either 5 or 10 cents. And to go downtown on the streetcar, it was 7 cents. Or a token, and you could get 4 tokens for a quarter. Or if you had a pass, a dollar was an unlimited pass for a whole week. So you could go on all the streetcars and the buses anytime you wanted if you had a pass. But they had a different color every week, so you had to buy a new pass every week. We normally work with tokens, so we bought 4 tokens for a quarter. So to go downtown, I needed 2 tokens and 15 cents. 10 cents for the movies, 5 cents for the popcorn.
After you graduated from college, what did you want to come back to Roanoke? Did you know that you were going to come back to Roanoke, or did you have job opportunities here?
Well, of course, when I graduated, I was in Roanoke, because I graduated from Roanoke College. So I immediately went to work teaching in the Roanoke Public Schools. But if there ever was a dog's life, I knew that was going to be a dog's life. So I very quickly wanted to go on to graduate school and teach at the college level. And Roanoke College was kind enough to hire me back as a part-time instructor. So that gave me a taste of college teaching, and it certainly was a whole lot nicer than public school teaching. It was a lot less work, and it was a much more pleasant environment. And so I went on then to graduate school, and I kept my hand in the drugstore. Bob was running the drugstore, of course, and bearing most of the responsibility, but whatever help I could give him, I gave him. But I had my eyes set on those days on becoming a college teacher. But I realized very quickly also that too was going to be not the most promising thing in the world, because that was a period when a great many people were coming out of graduate school wanting to get jobs teaching in college. And I could see myself, you know, ending up in a third-rate college for a third-rate career. And so I had a chance to go into politics, and I took it. And I was in politics for more than 16 years, and then I went into journalism for 12 years. But all that time, I was still fundamentally a businessman and doing business things.
What kind of politics were you involved in?
I was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates in 1967, representing Roanoke and Salem and Roanoke County. And I served in the House for 12 years, and I was elected to the State Senate and served one term in the State Senate and was defeated for re-election in 1983. And then I ran for Congress in 1984 and was defeated for that. And then I took up journalism, which I guess you'd say was kind of a consolation prize for having. But I enjoyed politics. It's tremendously challenging, and I enjoyed journalism. It's you had to be constantly thinking about what your piece was going to be and drawing materials together. And it was really an extension of the study of history, because it was all based upon gathering information and putting a proper characterization on that information. As that is the great thing that the study of history should teach you, and that is to take an honest and honorable approach to the facts, and not to bring a biased, prejudiced point of view to the facts. You can't help but be biased and prejudiced, of course, but you've got to go where the facts lead you, or where the information leads you, as best you can determine it. History is a tremendously challenging thing because it's so vast in scope. It's, you know, it's much vaster than any subject that you could possibly imagine, because it contains the whole history of the human race. And you can't even pretend to know more than a tiny fraction.
And so your journalism, it was always for the Roanoke Times, and you said it syndicated to other...
It was syndicated to a number of other Virginia newspapers. And there was no money in that, just as there was no money in teaching, but because I had a business career also, I was able to afford to do those things.
And it was a history column you wrote about?
No, it was primarily about politics. It was primarily, because that was more of my natural calling, was to political history. Because I've always believed that whether it's a city like Roanoke or a state like Virginia or a country, that the success or the failure, or let's say the mediocre results, will always depend upon the nature of the politics that prevails. And the nature of those politics must come up from the people. You can have good leaders like, you know, James Madison and Washington, and they're great to have, but you can't count on that. It must be the common sense of the common people that reflects itself through the political process. And that makes all the difference. So you see a country like England, which is small and relatively poor of resources, being a tremendous success, and a vast country like Brazil or Russia, with all the resources in the world, not matching that success. And it's because of the difference in the political system that they developed. Not that the English or the Americans ever had a perfect political system, and of course there was always corruption and injustice and all of that, but they developed a better and more durable political system. And that brings it right back to Roanoke. You look at the glory days of Roanoke. It was based to a great extent on good, sound politics and good, sound judgment on the part of the people to point Roanoke in the right direction, to make it a growing, progressive city that it was in the early part of this century and on into the 1960s.
Do you have a favorite memory about growing up in Roanoke, or something that is your fondest liking of Roanoke that you'd like to share with us?
I guess the favorite memory of people of my age would be the Thanksgiving Day football game between VMI and VPI in the 20s and 30s and 40s. It died out pretty much by the early 50s because VPI was moving on to be a much bigger school with a much bigger athletic program. But the football game, which was held on Thanksgiving Day for many, many years here in Roanoke, because Lexington was a very small place, Blacksburg was a very small place, they didn't draw big crowds. And that's the reason Victory Stadium was built, was to accommodate the VMI-VPI football game. And the whole town, I think it was in many ways greater than Christmas, though, because all the excitement was concentrated into one day. And you had people that came into town, the governor would come, and you had parties, the hotels would be full, and the Corps of Cadets from both schools would march to the stadium from the railroad depot, march up Jefferson Street to Victory Stadium, and it would be completely full. People would be trying to get tickets. There would be people along Reserve Avenue there trying to sell pennants and buttons and things like that. So it is very memorable.
So you attended those games?
I attended several of them. I was probably a little young. In the real glory days were probably in the late 1930s when VMI had a pretty strong team. And my oldest brother was a student at VMI, graduated in 1940. So in 36, 37, 38, those years, he would, of course, come home and bring his friends, and it would be a big event.
Did your wife grow up in Roanoke?
She grew up in Petersburg, and we met in Richmond when I was in the legislature. She was around the legislature working as a lobbyist, and that's the way it happened.
Okay. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you that you'd like to mention?
I think I would close by sort of repeating what I wrote for a book that has either come out or is about to come out on the same theme, and you may know about it. I forget the name of the man down in North Carolina that's putting it together. I'm sure you've heard of it. I am very glad that I had the benefit of my parents being of the Victorian age, because they were born at the end of the 19th century, and they had absorbed as most of the people of their generation had absorbed the Victorian ideals, which was primarily a pursuit of respectability and optimism, because after all, this was a generation that had seen the industrialization of the country. They'd seen the coming of the telephone, the motor car, the radio, all of those things. So they were very optimistic people. And this pursuit of respectability was a very peculiarly Victorian thing. And I think we've lost that to a great extent. People no longer care too much about seeming to be respectable. In fact, they almost seem to want to be regarded as disreputable or not respectable. I mean, in the way they dress. I mean, in those days, when you went to church, you dressed up. You went downtown, you dressed up. You wanted to make sure that your kids were always, you know, well scrubbed and well brushed. It's the pursuit of respectability. Certainly, in my growing up in the 30s and 40s, I think the great thing that I would take away would be the sense of trusting. Of safety, that this was a very safe environment, and that people could be trusted. I think we've lost so much of that, and I think it can be exemplified by the fact that the population of the city of Roanoke is roughly the same as it was 40 years ago. When I was first elected to the House of Delegates, the population is roughly the same. But in that time, 1967, 40 years ago, the entire police department was housed on one half of the ground floor of the old municipal building, the white brick building opposite the newspaper office. So they had one half of the downstairs, and the jail occupied all of the top floor. I'm sure that was crowded and it was inadequate in many ways, but if you would quantify the space that the police department occupies today, it would probably be 10 or 12 or 15 times as much space, and yet we are basically the same population. You look at the Department of Social Services, they had a relatively small office. I remember they moved maybe in the late 60s or early 70s up to an old car dealership on Luck Avenue that was probably 4,000 or 5,000 square feet. Now they're out there on Williamson Road, and you know, they probably have 25,000 or 30,000 square feet of space, again for basically the same population. So it shows you the mammoth changes, and most of those changes are fed off of politics and the development of the politics of the country in the last 50 years has made Roanoke, like many other, like my wife's hometown of Petersburg and the city of Richmond itself and Norfolk and many other cities like that, to be repositories of people who need help. You know? So the economy of Roanoke when I was growing up was a very self-reliant, free enterprise type of economy. And today, it's an economy based mainly on transfer payments of the government payments for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, etc. So, you know, it's not something anybody can do anything about particularly because it has a tremendous political force behind it. So I would say that that would be my perspective, my parents' generation, a generation yearning for respectability, to a great extent coming out of the country, being very grateful for things like public water, public sewage, electric lights, telephone, all of those things, believing in progress, having a great deal of trust and faith, and now a time that is rather pessimistic and fearful, and where there's a lot of fear, because fear sells. It sells for the media, it sells for the politicians. And so we live in an age governed to a great extent by fear and pessimism, as opposed to that time when I grew up, where we were optimistic and trusting.
Thank you for spending your afternoon with us, Mr. Garland.
My pleasure.